Hello, and welcome to Rule of Carnage. This is a podcast that we put on the internet so that you can listen to it. In this podcast, we talk, as we ever do, on the topic of designing better miniature games. My name's Mike. I've designed some. His name's Glenn. He's designed some. We are in the midst of a short series here on the topic of when should something be a miniatures game? We bump into this question quite a lot, and our lovely Discord community, click the link in the show notes below to join our Discord community. People are often wrestling with this question because when you get infused with an idea for a cool game, sometimes it's not always immediately obvious that the miniatures that you're imagining being in it are actually the best expression of that game. And so we've considered a couple of different ways of tackling this question in terms of, if your game is about something or something else, how would you, what would the clues be that it's a good candidate for a miniatures game? We have talked a couple of times now about the fact that we think that these miniatures games are about the relationships of markers in, you know, models and terrain in physical space, and that they are unique in that they can accept any kind of physical object can be thrown down into the play area, and somehow the magic circle will transmute it into a piece of game material, and we can put a shoe and say, oh, this is a blocking terrain, we know what this does. I think one of the things that is perhaps more cryptic to me, although I've played a lot of board games and indeed have played a lot of Euro games, one thing that's less obvious to me when I think about miniature games, because I tend to come at them from a sort of models and, you know, the loveliness of what it will look like on the table first, is an idea that Glenn has thrown around a couple of times on this podcast about how you kind of tackle the pacing and the arc of your game, and specifically how you deal with the fact that you want the beginning of the game to be a sort of lovely potential filled spectrum of opportunities, and you want the end of the game to be extremely tense and exciting, and there are a number of ways of achieving that kind of acceleration towards an exciting conclusion. And Glenn, you have got names for two, one of which I think you've made up, but tell us a little bit about laddering and zeroing.
Yeah, so one of the classic pieces of advice that get given to neophyte game designers in the board game area is that you cannot be doing the same thing on your last turn as you did on your first turn. And
that
like
would be just a that would be a bad game.
That would be a sort of, that would be the sort of thing that a publisher will give you in like a note when he refuses your game. You know, what is different about what you're doing on the last turn as what you're doing on the first turn? And I've in...
Even though things like whist and stuff are kind of that?
Well, I mean, even whist, you start off with a certain number of cards, you're meant to chuck a card out, like, each round. So by the last round, you, like... So it's at least different.
Oh, no, that's true. Yeah. If you're playing that kind of, yeah, that descending and...
Yeah.
So we always play the V shape where you end up with more cards, but whatever.
And I think that many people would say, yeah, you know, who plays whist a lot? Would you try and sell somebody whist in the modern day?
All right, fine.
And a term I have heard knocked around in a handful of game design blogs and things for the way that most board games do this is a laddering process. And I think sort of having tried to look this up due to talking about this conversation before having this conversation, I think that might have been taken from game design psychology and user interface. But anyway, the idea being like, if you imagine an engine building game, you start off able to do like really weedy, crappy little things, and then you build a bit of an engine and that poops out more stuff with which you can build more engine and blah, blah, blah. And then by the end of the game, on the last turn, you're cranking this mightiest machine that chucks out millions of dollars and etc etc etc, so that like on the last turn you feel like you've really done something, you've really progressed. It feels very, very different from your first turn. And this is a sort of, this is the idea of laddering, that the reason your last turn is different from your first turn is that you are much, much more powerful and influential, and you're doing much more cool stuff on your last turn. Now, war games, miniatures war games, and sort of boxed tabletop war games as well, that's almost certainly clearly not the case. At some point in between the first turn and the last turn, a lot of your dudes have had their heads blown off, and so you are not more powerful on the last turn than your first turn. You are almost certainly much, much weaker. And that should...
And maybe not even... And power almost feels like a kind of loaded term there, because you could interpret power as ability to influence the outcome of the game, but like just in terms of raw like capabilities, like the number of spellcasters and artillery pieces and psykers, and like you've just got less stuff to deal with available to you as like the sort of the opposite of an engine builder.
Yeah, like, yeah, I mean, the classic board game example of this is obviously chess. You know, at the start of a chess game, you've got tons of pieces and tons of choices, and the end of a chess game, you've got barely any choices at all. But definitely the end of a chess game is way more interesting than the start of a chess game, despite the fact you've got, in theory, way more choices at the start of a chess game.
Right, so we know that laddering is not, like, the only way to create an interesting end game.
Yeah, and why is it that chess is more interesting at the end, and why does it seem to be that war games are more interesting at the end, despite you having fewer choices and less of your toys and etc. etc. And I've dumped the name of zeroing onto this, because it feels like, well, it's like you're zeroing in on a target. You know, it's like you're a bomber plane going in for a run, and the takeoff is completely dull, and the closer you zero in on your target, the more interesting, exciting and important your choices.
But also the pun being that you go from 100% of your force to potentially 0% of it.
Yes you also literally zero your force as you go along. And part of what I think is it sort of intrinsic to the zeroing process is that at the start of a game that relies on zeroing, you've got a lot of largely meaningless or very obscure, very bushy choices that might turn out to be the choices that are going to influence the end of the game, but it's really hard to tell whether they are or not. It's really hard to tell whether, like, the opening movement of a unit in Warhammer was particularly significant. And then as your guys get knocked off, it becomes more and more obvious which choices are incredibly important and are really pivotal. And so while you are making fewer choices, it feels like each of the choices you make is more powerful. You know, you are making choices that more heavily influence the end of the game. Almost certainly you're not, but they definitely look that way. It definitely looks like the things you do on the last or next to last turn of a game of Warhammer, you know, sort of pivot and turn the game in a way that the things you did in the first two turns aren't. Like, to the degree where in Hobgoblin you've tried to hack out the first turn because it feels like you're never making any interesting decisions during it, you know, and as what is going to decide the game comes into clearer and clearer focus, the choices we make become more and more significant seeming, and the game feels like it is picking up momentum and picking up speed and moving towards a cinematic climax. And it's interesting, actually, like, a lot of video games go down this route. Like, you know, various first-person shooters, a lot of the time you get loaded up on, like, weaponry and armor and health before you go into the boss fight, so that ideally you kill the boss with like your last bullet when you're on 1% health, and there's your climactic moment. And it's one of the problems with laddering, where just as you get to the point where you're having the most fun and you're cranking this, look at my awesome splendor engine and look at the greatness it's doing and the things it's pooping out, and oh, and now it's over. Mm-hmm. And some people do say it's like, and sometimes you get a point where people are like, oh, if I had one more turn, if only I had one more turn.
Yeah, no, like, we've routinely played Race for the Galaxy to like 15 planets rather than 12, or 14 rather than 12. I can't remember exactly the numbers, because me and my dad were always like, but we just got it humming.
Yeah, and in a really good game, you feel that way when it ends. So you go, let's just do one more turn just to see. And then you play like one or two more turns. You go, all right, that's why they cut it off at that point. They really knew their onions because it's great just getting there. But once I've got a
Yeah.
hold of it, it's sort of like, fine, I'll turn the knobs and poop will spit out the far end and that'll be lovely. But with zeroing, you don't have to worry about that so much because it's like, well, everyone's got all of the toys they're going to have at the start of the game. Maybe you have to worry about, are they going to get their favorite toy taken off like really early and never get to see it be the awesomeness that it is? But certainly, it's a different way of sort of making it so that what you do on the last turn isn't the same as what you do on the first turn, and a different way of making that interesting. Now,
Okay, so we have the definitions. Like, so what do we do with these definitions? So I've got a game idea. Should this be a miniatures game? How do I intersect this pair of definitions with my new idea for a miniatures game? What am I looking for? What clues am I looking for?
well, I mean, the sort of the, not the obvious, but one of the things from that description is, what level of bringing new troops on, assuming that you're doing some sort of war game, like what level of adding things onto the tabletop as the game progresses, is there going to be? And what probability is there that the things you are going to add onto the tabletop are meant to be mysterious and interesting and decided during the game? Because it's like, I've having this conversation actually in the Discord at the moment of somebody who wants to have a game with where you can summon in like a big mighty like centerpiece model, and it's like, well, if there's a possibility that you're not going to get to summon in your big, lovely centerpiece model, then I've made you paint a lovely big centerpiece model that's loads of fun to play with. And I've gone, not for you today, but equally, if you're definitely
And
going to.
so that's not necessarily saying, well, it's not saying that's intrinsically good or bad. It's just saying that that's sort of fighting against the conventions of this form. Because like the game itself doesn't care, but like as a cultural experience, you care as a player.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and as an example for this, I think it would be fair to say that one of the larger barriers to entry to playing A Billion Suns is the fact that, people don't know exactly what ships they're going to need when they're playing, and people are sometimes expected to like maybe jump a bunch more ships in on like turn two and.
Right, and I was thinking about this because this was part of Glenn and I were chatting about whether A Billion Suns has laddering in it or not, and it got me thinking about like for me, and this is just because this is where I started with these sorts of board games. Like Settlers of Catan has a very obvious, although somewhat simple, laddering system where I collect resources so that I can build settlements or cities, and then I collect more resources so I can build more settlements and cities. And the comparison here between A Billion Suns and Catan was I was thinking, well, the reason Catan can do this is because you only get five settlements and four cities, so I've got like a limited pool of things. It's like, well, wait a minute, if you just had like two battleships and five gunships and that's all you were allowed to build, wouldn't that sort of be an effective way of dealing with laddering, which is spoilers how Rotwalden is dealing with this as well. Like, so I guess one of the questions I've got about laddering and zeroing is this a convention or a tendency, or like this is just where the water runs downhill? It's not formally required that you choose one or other of these routes, and you could potentially make a real-time strategy game as a miniatures game. It's just you're going to have to fight through the demons of hell to make it work.
Well, I think also again, and I think this whole process of deciding what sort of game you're making ends up being like a series of like feedback loops, where like you, as you were saying, well, if I say you're allowed X many battleships and X many corvettes and X many fighters in A Billion Suns, then maybe it is an actual laddering thing because, and it's like, Well, if you've given me a specific list of exactly what I am going to be allowed, not a suggestion, why not stick all those into a box for me? You've told me exactly what I'm right. going to be allowed. You've given me a very specific thing. This is exactly what you'll get. You don't get like upgrade. They're going to be this sort of preset thing. Put them in a nice box for me and save me a whole bunch of hassle. And tell you what, while you're putting things in a box, are there some other solutions to some other problems in your game design that might be handy if you can put bespoke things in, you know, and then it feeds back into itself? Where it's
no, like, sure. And that's when I would, but it won't be the episode where I do go off on my rant about miniature cinematography and stuff. But yeah, like I see what you mean, which is that you're like, well, you're sort of shifting this counter lever backwards and forwards between possible kind of product poles that you could end up on. And if you're saying, well, what I need is this, what I see is this laddering where I can bring in a certain range of objects, and that range is discrete. Well, okay, now we have a discrete element to the game, and so we could maybe think about, well, are there other things that could be discrete as well?
Yeah, and I think also, like, the whole of your game is a holistic thing, and it's a product as well as being sort of a game. And I think that the best expression of a game is the one that is easiest for players to access, you know, quick for them to get a hold of, easy to understand, and easy for them to get to the meat of what the fun thing is. And you know, there are a set of barriers involved with a miniatures game inherently. And they're barriers we accept because the benefits of them, the benefit of me just getting a book for a miniatures game is, well, that's cheap for something that I can then have be the biggest game that I own with the most stuff involved in it. It looks absolutely stunning. It covers a 6-foot by 4-foot table, and it costs a fraction of what a game that takes up a fraction of the space and looks a fraction as good does when it's in a boxed game. But if I'm going to do it in such a way where giving you a box makes your life easier, cheaper, more fun, then okay, well, how else can I design this? What else can I put into it? What other choices can I make? How else will that inform my design decision? And sometimes it's just one or two of these things that make you sort of start going, oh, well, just a minute. If I'm putting it in a box, I can put in like some bespoke cards. Oh, and I can then put in some counters. Oh, and that thing that I was doing with like buildings and like doing this really arcane thing of defining a building, I'll give people the buildings as like cardboard things, and I can cut the terrain section from 50 pages to one. And you know, and that's when I think your game sort of starts going more, okay, well, now we've got a boxed game, we've got different choices, different concerns, different affordances, different abilities, you know. And I think it ends up sort of snowballing into itself at that point.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I will pick on one thing that you said there, because I'm not sure I completely agree with it, which is, I think one of the things that I am often considering is that the best expression of a game is not necessarily the easiest expression of the game to get into, because like on the journey from accessibility to inaccessibility is this wonderful, like, happy place of investment where I take a little bit of like escape velocity to get over the hump of being involved in my game. And now I'm really involved in your game and I'm excited because I bothered to get the miniatures or paint the terrain or whatever. And I think that for a kind of game like ours, which has the potential for a hobby loop, I think we end up in a place where some of the very like core sort of tenets of like, well, you know, designing things should be obvious what they do, and they should be easy to get into, and products should be accessible. I think, you know, with a product like ours, like, there is an element which, like, well, there's somewhere in between there where it's like, has to be difficult enough. I'm not saying gatekeep it, but it's like, has to be difficult enough that when you've got into it, you're like, yes, I'm here, I'm one of the tribe.
It is tricky. As an independent game designer, you may as well get benefit out of that, because the people who are playing your game are going to be the in crowd anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, five of them and their mate. So you may as well make it like, you know, into a bit of
luxuriate in your ivory tower.
But I also think it's like, the places where you make it hard for somebody to play the game are specific choices you have to make. If it's like, oh, you've got to acquire these obscure models and kit bash them and do all these kinds of things, well, that's lovely. That's an evolved process, and you can then show off your kit bashed model. If it's like, okay, you have to print off 50 cards with like matching card backs and, produce them out and cut them out very finely, it's a bit more like, no, that is not a nice thing to make life hard for people. That's the thing where you should have given them that deck of cards, damn
All
it.
right, so potentially the last question, but we shall find out on laddering and zeroing. In your opinion, or in your experience of sort of knocking about designs in this direction, do you feel that laddering requires more cardboard components than zeroing tends to require? Because zeroing can start with the things that we had anyway, which is miniatures, and by a process of attrition just naturally provide that game, whereas laddering has to have some cards or boards or ding dongs.
I think that if you are interested in a game that is built on laddering, I think that cardboard bits and bobs will make the game more enjoyable and more accessible
Right,
and
rather than having to have more and more fingers in your rule book to go, okay, well, now I've got this, and now I've actually got this as well, and now I've got this, and I have to remember all the rules.
Well, yeah, and also, like, one of the things of laddering is that you don't necessarily want to know which options you're gonna be presented with halfway through the game at the start of the game. And so sometimes you
Right,
want
because
to.
otherwise there would be no mystery. It would just be like, well, I'm pre-programmed my route through this tech tree.
Exactly. And so you sometimes want to pull out the cards, and it's like, oh, well, this one's a hydropod and this one's a hollow ship. I don't know what either of them do. Oh, luckily this card has got written on what both of them do. I'm literally learning and processing, the way they're going to fit into my engine as I'm pulling them, which necessitates, bits of cardboard. And then, once you're giving somebody one bit of cardboard, you may as well give them another bit to make their life easier. And probably if you're laying out these cards that are in a tech tree that relate to other cards, it might be nice to give them something to lay them onto that will have some iconography that will explain what the hieroglyphics on the cards are, and you're onto a whole thing. Whereas, yeah, if you're doing a zeroing process, I come to the table with my army list, which I have written and studied, and I know exactly what everything in it does, and I've got the miniatures representing it. I don't need any, cards and doodads on the table because I know the stat line for my ogres, and I know exactly what my hero. I need like a
Right,
one.
and throughout the game, what happens is I just need to remember fewer and fewer of those facts that I know.
Exactly. And I'm at no point am I going to suddenly pick up a new magical item and then have to draw it out of the deck. And, and obviously I could. We could do that. We could give you objectives that suddenly give you an extra power that you didn't have. But it's a very limited and tricky potato to boil that particular.
And so, drawing the comparison back to TCGs, which we did in the last conversation, when I compare this to Magic, we actually end up with like two deep, complicated games that afford a lot of pre-planning, one of which uses laddering and one of which uses zeroing. Because at the beginning of a game of Magic, I've got nothing, and I haven't built my tableau, and by the end, I'm slamming down all kinds of spells and monsters, and all kinds of groovy stuff is happening. Whereas in Warhammer, I slam down a massive load of stuff, and we charge forward, and yeah. I think what's interesting as well is thinking about like the dis so we were looking. I was looking at the characteristics of games and slingshotting some pictures of graphs to Glenn from the section on. I forget what it's called. It's like the decision density part of it. And I think what's interesting is that in those two games, you can sort of describe the how interested and complicated my decision making is in a fairly similar arc, in that like whether it's a game of Magic or whether it's a game of Warhammer, like I kind of know what I'm doing right at the beginning. There's not that many interesting decisions to make. I'm just going through the motions of getting set up. I'm kind of coming to this knowing like, well, the cards in my hand that matter because I've practiced with this deck. I know which cards are important, or like I know which units need to be moving. And, you know, I don't have a lot of, I got a lot of decisions I could make, but very few of them matter, or very few of the options I'm presented with I'm actually going to consider and take. Whereas in the middle, when it gets very messy and it could go either way, there's an enormous spike in interest about how I've got a technically limited now set of decisions from where we began, or rather in Warhammer it's come down, in Magic it's come up, but we're in this sort of sweet spot where like there's a lot of interesting decisions, many of them are quite juicy, a lot of the options seem equally important, I'm not sure exactly where to put pressure or resources, and then towards the end the snowball started rolling and we kind of know where we are and the decisions again become a bit less interesting, and that's fine because we're kind of trying to hurry towards the end because we kind of see what's happening. And so that narrative arc is the same in terms of my emotional involvement and decision making process for the game. Laddering and zeroing just, I guess, gave me different initial board states, and they just provided different kind of pathways to achieve that same kind of musical arc.
Yeah, I think it's a bit about like what you want, maybe what you want the emotional experience to be at the end of the game, you know, because a lot of the time with laddering, it's not much of a choice on the last turn. You pull the lever and then you watch the cogs dance and see your genius, you know, taking place, you know, on the tabletop. In the final, you know, moments of a war game, the two general
remaining bloodied combatants, finally, yeah, two axes embed in each other's skulls simultaneously.
Exactly.
A single crow crows across the battle. Yeah, no, it's definitely, yeah, different.
You know, how do you want your player to feel powerful and important? Do you want them to like pull a crank and see their majesty take place that they have built up as a self-made man? Or do you want them to be like, he's the last guy that boff, there we go, that was significant because it was the closed fist of judgment mailing down upon my opponent, and it was definitive because that was the last guy in the unit, so I know that it was significant. And it's, yeah, and I think that I do see people sometimes doing, talking about doing real-time strategy games as minis games.
And God, I mean, yeah, don't even talk to me about it. Like, number one, I'm obsessed with it. And number two, I've kind of tried, did I succeed or fail with A Billion Suns? I'm not ready to admit either way.
And the thing is, it's one of the things, I don't think it's an immutable problem. I think that doing it in a way where it wouldn't be better to give people cards and counters is what's the hard, is what is the hard problem. And I'm not, you know, you totally can do it with minis, but it feels like ice skating uphill, and it feels like sometimes giving people a bitter little sweetie to suck on, where it's like, I paid for this thing and it's just not getting used.
So this is what's bugging me out at the moment is, obviously, Go is an extremely discrete game. It's got a grid. You place things on intersections. But it's got a very obvious laddering thing where, like, you begin with a pristine board and then complexity builds across, you know, the hundreds of moves. And the thing that's, like, the relationships between pieces are very important. Obviously, they're discreetly important. It matters whether it's literally next to it and what the lines of things that are connected are. But it does make me think, like, is there a game that takes two cues from Go, which is pieces don't move but remain interesting in their relationships, and you begin with nothing and you like and things grow? And I don't know what that is, and maybe it's not even like a, it doesn't even resemble a war game, but something to do with like, I don't know, like I'm just thinking about this idea of like, well, how do I put down immutable things, whether they're towers or flowers or something, and like it matters that the light can hit a particular flower at, you know, a certain time of day or something, and the flowers can't move but where I placed them was important, and blah 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 blah.
Yeah, but then, and I'd say doing that in a way where it would not be better if it were a boxed game is for me the important and difficult question, because there's definitely games where that's interesting. Those games definitely exist. Are they better if they are a minis game? Not sort of, I can do it as a minis game. You probably can do it as a minis game. If you put the player through enough torture, you probably can. but maybe don't put them through
Well,
the
they,
paper.
yeah, and this I think is hugely connected to the conventions of the form, and I think that's one of the struggles I've got with this overarching conversation is I'm constantly tripping myself up on what is a intrinsic strength of the form versus what is a current social sort of reality of the form, which is there is a certain kind of audience, there is a certain kind of social convention around these things, there's a certain kind of product availability. Like if I wanted to make, because I'm obsessed with the idea of making a miniatures game that uses farm animals. I know I'm not the first person to think of this, but like, you know, my mum grew up with farm animals, you know, my kids have these little farm animals. Like it's a very common physical toy that very much resembles Gaslands cars or, you know, toy soldiers that the original war games emerged from. Like they ought to be something to do with farm animals, but no one has bothered to come up with it yet.
Well,
And
it's
I think that is not to do with the convention. I don't think that's to do with the formal constraints of miniature games. I think that's to do with more to do with the current cultural conventions around it.
I don't know, possibly it's like I say, it's a thing of, okay, well, what is that game about? Well, it's going to be to some degree about like maybe the AI of the creatures. Well, AI is easier if I put it on a grid and give you a card to operate it with, right? So boxed game then. Boxed game, or you're making life pointlessly hard for people. It's like,
or it's an Animal Farm thing where it's like, well, actually they're just soldiers. And it's like, well, you just made another war game. It's
yeah,
not.
Just, yeah, yeah. And it's like, okay, well, why is non-discrete space through which the animals move interesting, important, and better than discrete space? It's like the thing you're talking about, placing counters onto the table. It's like, why do I care that I can put a shoe on the table and the relationship between the two counters either side of it is interesting? And why is that more interesting than having a grid and at the start of setup sticking just a flat, mindless barrier into the grid, and that therefore will make life easier for me and easier for my players? It's why is it better as a minis game, you know, than a box game, rather than, you know, can it's not, you know, ask whether you should do it rather than whether you can do it. Take a
well,
leap.
And so, and I think this will probably transition us into a final conversation in this series of why should something be a miniatures game. So I'm going to contain my final subtopic on this.
We'll be back in just a second.
Mike, you're going to explain what it is that makes you think a game should be a miniatures game rather than anything else.
Yeah, so the start of each of these conversations, we've kind of highlighted two key things that Glenn and I are completely convinced are like essential to what it is that miniature games are. And one of them is an obsession with spatial relationships. Like if a game is not about the relationships in space, absolute distances, relative positions, it ain't a miniature game as I design them. And the other thing is that through some magical alchemy, these games have found a form where they can accept any physical object really into the play space, and the magic circle will transmute them into something that the game and the player understands by simply putting a can of Coke in the middle of my Gaslands track. I can say, you know, that's a heavy obstacle, and thus it is, and we know what to do with it. And there's almost no other game form that allows us that level of, like, I can't just like pull out my credit card, slip it into my hand of magic cards, and everyone is just cool with what that even is and how it works.
So, I mean, you know, definitely the credit card is the most powerful card in the game of Magic the Gathering, just saying.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's literally the driving force for it. So I think for me, one of the things that's emergent from the ability to put anything into the magic circle of these games and have it be understandable is the fact that you can therefore make anything that you like, and you can bring anything that you like, and you can basically create your own miniature world. This freedom to place objects unlocks this, basically the primary for me aesthetic pleasure of this form, which is that I can basically be miniature sort of photographer, I can be miniature cinematographer. And a lot of the things that I do when I approach a game design is I'm sort of thinking visually, and I'm thinking about what it is that I would find both cool to see on the table, but also what I would want to see in my imagination, which I can find ways to express in these little static ways that will then fire my imagination to see a piece of cinema in front of me. And so I think, and it's fun when you see this, like when you watch certain people on YouTube doing battle reports, some people will do this and some people won't, but like, because he filmed a couple of games of Hobgoblin recently, I was watching Peter and a couple of his friends on the Esoteric Order of Gamer recording some battle reports. And Peter is like me in that he will stop for a moment and he will get down to a certain angle and he will look and he will go, look at this. This looks amazing. Have you seen this? Look at this. It looks absolutely fantastic with the painted miniatures and the painted terrain. It all just fits together. And it just looks like a, you know, miniature war game table. But like, at that moment, with the investment that he's put into these objects and with that composition that he's looking at, there is a simple pleasure, an intrinsic pleasure, that you can place these models into a scene and you can explore that scene in three dimensions. You can move your viewpoint around that physical space. And also that this is part of an evolving picture and like a really slow stop motion 3D film, like across the game, something will unfold in front of you, which for me, it's got a very primal kind of childish delight in it. And so I think for me, there's a piece of when should something be a miniatures game, which is, have I got the components in the game's kind of idea to create something that's worthy of pointing a camera at? But more than worthy of pointing a camera at, because I mean that, euphemistically, is it worthy of me investing time in order to create this miniature world, and will I get something out of it? And I think that's both quite culturally, like, sort of, it seems to me that because there's a group of nerds that do this kind of thing in a specific set of genres, that it has a kind of magnetic attraction to certain visuals, but that it ought to be possible to do any number of kind of visually delightful expressions of, well, I want to see something and I would like to see it beautifully rendered in three dimensions so that I can enjoy it both statically and evolving through the game goes. Yeah, that's, yes, that's what I mean.
I mean, the thing with that for me is that it's more about the freedom to create any visual than arguably the, let's at least say, average quality of visual created. It's almost like the difference between a sort of a set moment in a video game and just being allowed to happen upon. If you're playing an open world video game and you happen upon a beautiful valley as the lights at the right point, you get this amazing sort of visual. Whereas if you're playing a game with like set pieces and you walk into a certain room and then it looks up
and the camera is taken from you and, oh wow, something we made, and you're like, cool, you made that, well done.
And that was pre-triggered, and it's like you might never come across the valley in the open world game, but you will definitely see the amazing ballroom or whatever in the game with the set pieces. And it's like, you know, most, you know, certainly high quality tabletop boxed games, when you lay them out, all look great. And many of them have you lay out the components in such a way that create a vista and a tableau and something that's even beautiful. And lots of games are about like literally making beautiful pictures. Whereas I've played plenty of minis games where people have lined up against me with bases with a pile of metal pieces dropped on top, and they've gone, well, that is that thing. You can't, it's what you see is what you get. I've just not glued it together or painted it. And that definitively looks much worse than every boxed game, like in cinematic and visual appeal and flair that I've ever come across in my life. You know, and it's like, the freedom of the fact that people can put anything onto the tabletop with these sorts of games involves the freedom that they can put down absolute baloney for one of these games,
right? And critically, and listeners, Glenn has very many painted armies and mostly plays with painted models, and I care much more about this and rarely have painted armies. Make of that what you will. But I think you're absolutely hitting on the critical thing here, which is that the other side of this coin is player ownership. And I think it links into a couple of other things that we've talked about, which is the ability to put anything into this magic circle and have it be accepted by the game. And the fact that, as we discussed in some previous episodes, like, these games and players of these games are relatively more tolerant of complexity. The complexity leads to depth in many cases in these games, which allows self-expression both in game terms but also in hobby terms. And so you can kind of use the self-expression or feel the potential to use this self-expression, which honestly is almost as important and probably is more valued overall, even if we don't admit it, to create your own stories, to differentiate yourself or your models or your armies from your peers. And that, I don't know, this, like, even if the mass-produced entertainment experience is higher quality in every measurable dimension, you're the co-creator of this miniature world that's in front of you, and the stories that are emergent are your stories. And there's just an incredible sort of, I don't know, it's just way more meaningful as an act of play for me in many regards, where it's like, well, you and I created this together in front of us, this is play, rather than enjoying something that somebody else made and sort of sitting through. I don't know. Does that make sense?
I mean, it makes sense, but I think, and I really would love to have like a full-on philosophical conversation about the nature of,
I mean, literally, that's the purpose of this podcast, Claire. Do it!
Well, no, look, I mean, to my
mind, I won't be able to keep up, but you're welcome.
No, to my mind, what you're talking about thereabout is a defining feature of games as an art form, as a sort of a performative shared art form, as opposed to other art forms. You know, quite the act of play. Okay, so when you create a work of art, which is like a painting, you go for a process and then you produce a product, and the product is the work of art. The painting is the work of art. When you create a game, you go for a process to create a product that is not the work of art, and then that product creates a process which is shared with other people, and that process that is created by the product that's created by the process is the work of art. And there's something really weird about that, something really ephemeral and peculiar and philosophically difficult that differentiates games from every other art form. Every other art form, the artist goes through a process, and the process is kind of unimportant. It doesn't really matter whether he's using oil paints or hanging upside down or whatever else. What matters is the product. We're in a place where the product kind of doesn't matter. The product isn't an art form. It isn't the art.
The product is a tool that allows you to access the experience.
The actual piece of art. The actual piece of art is, you know, because I think that art is about sort of instantiating a moment, taking a moment and making it into a permanent product. If an artist sees something, a painter sees something, they take that seeing and they put it onto a canvas or a whatever else it happens to be. And now everybody can see what that artist saw. The moment has been turned into a permanent product of some kind. If a musician hears music, they can write that music down and it can be played, and then that can be produced again and again and again. A games designer is trying to instantiate what it is to make a certain set of decisions, to perform a certain set of actions. We can't put that into a thing in the way that we put a painting into a thing. We have to do it in such a way that we end up sharing it with another human being. And then that other human being sort of unwraps and creates it at the tabletop. You know, I think that that's one of those things where this is more definitive, a thing about all games, as opposed to everything else sort of in the world. As opposed to it is
right. Whilst I agree with that on the grand scale, that like, And honestly, like listening to you talk, all I can see is Shannon's communication model of like the transmission of the signal to the receiver and what we would normally think of as the sort of transmission of that idea is this work in the middle. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is that, yes, I agree with all of that in general terms. I think specifically, a comparison could be with role-playing games, where role-playing games allow me a sense of self-expression. They create the magic at the table. The instantiation is local to me. The thing that the games designer gave me was more akin to the score that I as a musician will perform from, not the piece of music as recorded. But it provides different modalities for that to emerge. It's about speech, it's about imagination, it's about theatre, it's about shared story creation. And the shared story creation, I think, is very much shared with miniature games. But miniature games modality is just ever so slightly different. It's about physical creation. It's about the sort of the self-expression of taking, you know, shared objects that we can both buy. You know, we can both buy the same Space Marines, but we can paint them differently and we can attach different stories to them. And, you know, I guess a bit like the tactical elements of RPGs, we can also take the constraints that we're given and express ourselves in different game ways, you know, different strategies and so forth. And so I think that, yes, this is a subset of a broader generalization about the way that games function as art. But I think that when I'm thinking about the question, when should something be a miniatures game, I personally are absolutely starting from a position of, do I see opportunities, do I feel opportunities to express both myself and to give other people the opportunity to express themselves and to tell stories using physical objects that they might be able to customize and create for themselves? Because I think if I'm not doing that, that is for me categorically the moment where I go, well, bollocks, this is just a boxed game. Like, I'll just give you some stuff that's of no, in no way customizable.
Okay, I mean, for me, I think that the question I'd be looking at there, or the way that I would interpret that is where is the place of interaction between human beings within this game? And what I mean is, it's like, if I'm playing a miniatures tabletop war game, I'm expressing myself like on the tabletop in the way that my things like clump into your things on the tabletop. If I'm playing, I'll go sort of right sort of in many ways down the other end of the scale, something like Blood on the Clock Tower, some sort of social deduction game, werewolves, whatever it happens to be, the interaction point is like is very directly, you know, me talking to you and trying to convince you of something which is a lie. You know, and everything else is sort of out of the way, and I'm only expressing myself directly to you as a person, an individual. Now, I could play, you know, Werewolves, Miller's Hollow, with a little mini of a guy, and I move him around the table over to another person, and that could be the person that I have to interact with. But that mini is total bullcrap at that point. It's not the game. It's not the way it's expressing. It's not the thing that I'm meant to care about. It's not where I'm meant to be putting myself while I'm playing. When I paint a particular mini and model a particular mini, it's because I'm like putting myself to some degree into that army. They are the people who are representing me, and I am at some point trying to imagine what they are seeing, literally tactically at various points, and the thing that is the focus is the minis, and that is what I want a person to pour themselves into in a way that I don't want them to do when I'm designing like a social deduction game.
Sure, but like, because we're getting philosophical, like the fact that I'm obsessed with these miniatures as the subject of my camera, like, it can still be an indirect subjectivity where, like, I am everything about this miniature story is important to me. Like, I am telling the story of this character. I'm obsessed with this character. You've got your own story. You know, we're overblowing this for effect, but, like, you know, we both just painted some miniatures. Like, it's fine. But, like, there are miniatures, and we, you know, ideally we are thinking, well, they at least have names, and they possibly even have some imagined backstory. But I think that, you know, I'm imagining shooting a movie of that character, whether, you know, literally or kind of, you know, half-assedly. I'm concerned with them as the protagonists of my story. And maybe in an army game, I'm much more interested in a couple of characters or that one champion that ends up emergently being an interesting moment in my narrative.
I think possibly, and this is a personal thing, I'm just not that interested in those kinds of things. I'm interested in where two players meet each other. I don't really care about what it looks like, if I'm in all honesty. I care about where you meet another human being and where you press up against them and what then happens. And it's like, so when I,
but then why make the effort on the hobby side? Like, why take the time, as you have done, to, like, make a wonderful, you know, ogre army where every hand is, you know, impressed in resin to make a frozen hand? Like, what does that mean for you? What does it signify?
Because I personally like doing that, and I have pride within it, and, you know,
is it purely intrinsic, or is it there an extrinsic social loop as well?
No, I think for me personally, it's part of the hobby, and it's a process that I go through, and it's a process that I inherently enjoy. But it's not something that, as a game designer, I give multiple hoots about.
That's absolutely fascinating.
And if, like,
because if you derived value from that, like, why wouldn't it be something that you would then consider engendering in others?
Because what I'm trying to do with a game is focus on a particular experience and get to that experience with the minimum of things, of barriers to it possible. You know, like, we SSO is a game about you deciding which of your friends is going to die. And if I could do it without using cards and counters, I would do it without using those things. The game has the bare minimum of what I can give you to make that happen in a sci-fi survival horror setting. And if I can get you to interact with another human being in an interesting way with fewer components, I will do it with fewer components. Now, I mean, the thing is, I like painting minis, I like modeling minis, I like having an army with a theme to it. I could do that without any kind of game, and people do that with no kind of game attached.
It's odd, because you often say, well, I'll only paint a miniature if I've got a game to play it.
Yeah, I will, but that's me. I can make these decisions for myself.
No, yeah, and I'm not accusing you of anything. I'm just it's for me, it's like it's part of that, like, it's part of that complete package. Like, well, I could build an army, but why would I? Like, I need a reason. I need a driver. I need a flywheel to get that going. For me, when I think about Gaslands, like, where people are spending time making Gaslands cars but not playing the game, I'm still delighted that I triggered an imaginative process in them that's led to something enjoyable to them. And one of the things that I love, one of the core reasons that I make the kinds of list building systems that I do make, and I've worked on three games in the last 3 months, and they all look exactly like the last three games. Like, I bloody love taking the infinity of possible units, boiling them down into 10 choices, and then allowing you to bolt guns on it. Like, it just feels great, because that's how miniatures work as well. And now I can accept any sort of physical object, just exactly as these games are good at, which is, I provide simple frameworks into which you can say, well, you know, sod it, any building that I make, any miniature that I construct, and in my case, like, any base you put it on, because, you know, why should that matter? Like, all of these things are saying, I want to provide to people the ability to own their experience and to create their own space, physical space populated with things that they have physically made. Because for me, that is almost the primary joy. And that's probably why I'm terrible at miniature games. But like, that for me is the primary joy of engaging with the thing in the first place.
Okay, so I'll say, you know, so I've just sort of designed a game that actually has built into it kit bashing and rules to encourage kit bashing and drive that to be part of the game. And I do not particularly care whether or not there are minis in the game or get rid of them if I could. You really care about minis being there in the cinematography of it, and you've just designed a game where people shove poker chips around a tabletop to be a Pacific fleet. What's that all about?
I don't know. That one I think is that actually the cinematography that I have in my mind is the maps that you see. And so for me, the visuals still drive the decision making, which is that you can't express why the Pacific War was interesting unless you zoom out to the point where there's no possible way that you can have a miniature that makes any sense. And so for me, the cinematography is still driving it. It's just that the cinematography demands that you have, you know, those maps with animated circles where it's just like, and then this thing came over here and then this thing came over here. So oddly, I think the cinematography drove me to what's the easiest, because initially I purchased a number of like 160 millimeter MDF circular bases, like sort of Warhammer monster bases. And I was trying to see if you could fit like 1/6,000th scale, like, fleet miniatures so that they would look comfortable as a battle group. Because, like, you know, when you've got those aerial shots of, like, you know, carrier battle groups, like, they look grand. It's a really good, but you can't make the physics work. The cinema of, like, the story doesn't work because the story is interesting when you've got something that's 600 miles wide. Yeah. So yeah. I think it does come down to that, like, yeah.
Okay, I mean, you know, for me, it feels like the Pacific Command is more of a game about the men taking the, you know, bluffs of 1,000 men's lives, and, you know, the betting and the that's to me why it's more interesting that it's a set of poker chips, because that is the thing. You are interacting with another human being in the way that you are hiding what is on the tabletop.
I think that's why when I found the solution, when I got to the possibility of poker chips as a solution, I was like, bam, everything clicks now. But like up until that point, I was experimenting with other kinds of solutions that still abstracted away from, you know, the physical silhouettes of ships not being important. But you're absolutely right. Like the ability to, the sort of the visual image of like two admirals looking at each other over a poker table, and one going to call the other's bluff? Like, yeah, that's why it then clicked together.
Okay, well, I mean, that conversation got a bit philosophical and free.
That's what happens at the end of a mini-series.
Absolutely. This was a conversation about why it is that Mike designs miniatures games as opposed to other sorts of games. We just had a bunch of conversations about why I make a thing be a miniatures game as opposed to another sort of game. Maybe you have a reason that you will make a game as a miniatures game as opposed to a card game, you know, or a board game or a counters game or vice versa. Tell us what makes you think a game should be a minis game. It should be the sort of game that we're talking about as opposed to something else. What it, does it matter that you're ice skating uphill to do it? If you can do it and nobody else has done it, maybe that's exactly the point of doing it. Tell us these things and more in the comment section. Hit the like and subscribe buttons while you're down there.
Do it.
They enjoy being hit. They're weirdos like that. follow if you're in that section through to the links section, go across onto our Discord and tell us there why you design the games that you design. And if you're looking at links and following them through, there's one to Mike's Patreon from where you can give him delicious, delicious money with which he can eat coffee or something. But other than that, I think that's going to be it from this episode of Rule of Carnage, this conversation. So thank you and goodbye.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.